This week, we're going to talk about radical gratitude, and I pray it will prepare you for a great Thanksgiving. Do you have these memories from your childhood, the same memories as I do? I remember my earliest memories as a child, whenever anyone would give me something, that my parents would ask always the same question. Do you know what it was? What do you say? And it was always like, don't embarrass me. And there's only one correct response, and you knew what it was. It was the first line of the first act of the play of your life, and that was, thank you. Well, my little sister, by the way, she's 14 years younger than me. This is a picture of me in high school holding my little sister. And yes, whenever I tell people about my little sister, I have to say, for some reason, we had the same parents. We're 14 years apart. I was an only child for 14 years. And then my little sister came along. And I remember one time when she was given a piece of candy, she came up with a different answer to that question. And I was surprised. She was given a piece of candy, and when our parents prompted her with, what do you say? With a cheek full of chocolate and as serious as she could be, she said, got any more? An original thinker she is. Now, that is hilarious with a small child, but at some point, as the years increase, that kind of attitude isn't funny anymore, is it? As people get older, because that idea of an I want more adult, nobody laughs at that. A got any more attitude in adults isn't funny. But yet, on the other hand, when there is gratitude, a generous expression of gratitude will melt any heart. And it will produce generosity in us. When there is gratitude, it causes us to want to give more and to be more generous. Gratitude produces generosity, and generosity produces gratitude. And when those two are working together, it's powerful. In our Bible passage today, we're going to see how one woman responded with generous gratitude. What did she respond to? Well, there's a family that Jesus did a lot of life with. And as he was preparing for his death, he was entering the last week of his life. It's no surprise that he swung through Bethany on the way to Jerusalem. And he spent some time with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Now, they were a unique family, maybe. I think they were atypical of families in that time because there were two sisters and a brother. There's nobody else in their family that's mentioned. It's just these three. And it's always these three. No other members are mentioned. Who knows whether there is others at any time, but whatever it is, and it's okay to speculate. When you read the Bible, ask questions, speculate. Say, what was it like to have been there? Why were they like this? It's possible, if you speculate, that Lazarus may have invited his sisters to come live with him so he could support them economically. Jesus had spent time with them before. It was in the 10th chapter of the New Testament book of Luke. A visit by Jesus is recorded there where Mary was sitting at Jesus' feet listening while Martha, her sister, was working her tail off serving their guests. And it prompted a conversation. Martha came up and talked to Jesus about Mary and said, doesn't it bother you? Have you not noticed how hard I'm working? And here sits my sister. Why don't you tell her to get up and help me? And Jesus just kind of smiled. I think he smiles more than you or I may give him credit for. But he smiled and just said, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, and it will not be taken from her. Mary was someone who found a home at Jesus' feet. And those words were literal and as well as figurative. When they were gathered in her home, she sat at his feet and listened as he taught. But there's also a figurative element that even though Jesus isn't here today, there's still, when we say sit at his feet, is talking about a posture of listening. A hunger to learn that comes from an understanding of who Jesus is. He is the gift of God. In the 11th chapter of John's writing in the New Testament, it's recorded that when Lazarus was ill, his sister sent word to Jesus, who was a distance away but close enough where he could have gotten there in time to heal their brother. And Jesus deliberately waited until Lazarus died before heading in that direction. He delayed his arrival by over 4 days. And when Jesus finally arrived, both sisters were distraught and probably disappointed. And each of them told Jesus privately, if you had been here, our brother wouldn't have died. In fact, each one said, my brother wouldn't have died. It was personal. Both had seen and heard of Jesus healing sick people, lame people, blind people, deaf people. But when their brother Lazarus died, so died their hope, their faith that Jesus would heal him. Their hope for a miracle died along with them. Apparently, everybody has their limits, and to them, death seemed to be beyond his. For when Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him and gave him that news. And when Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said the same thing. And then everyone went to the tomb together. Now, what they expected to find at the tomb was different. Jesus had a different idea of what was going to happen than the sisters did. And so when they went to the tomb, he arrived at the tomb and he found what was going to be a familiar sight for himself. There was a cave with a stone in front of it. And he said, roll the stone away. Roll the stone away, Jesus told them. But Martha, it says, the dead man's sister protested. Lord, he's been dead for 4 days. It's going to stink to high heavens. Oh, you have little faith sometimes, huh? Oh, we have little faith. Now, if our words are an overflow of our hearts, like the Bible says they are, then Mary's word reveals something about her heart. What was it? Well, that's why Jesus spoke to encourage her faith. And Jesus responded, and depending how you see God in these times, you're either going to see him with a smile or a frown, and whatever image you stamp on Jesus' face is going to be the tone with which he speaks. I hear him speak this way, in a reassuring tone of voice that says, didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe? Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe? You will see if you believe. And this is reassuring to me because there are times my faith is weak. That yes, there's an ability to believe that God can, that doesn't come with a God will. And sometimes those moments when we're tired and we're discouraged and we're wondering why God doesn't, we know that he can, but he hasn't, and we wonder if he will. And that was one of those moments that the girls did not expect a miracle. They expected that the miracle had died with the brother. What she believed was that Lazarus was dead and his body decomposing. For if she believed that Jesus was about to do a miracle, when Jesus said, roll the stone away, she would have said, hurry up, get it done. But instead of turning to those who had the strength to roll the stone away, she turned to Jesus and said, Lord, he's been dead 4 days. It's going to stink. And that's when Jesus said, didn't I tell you, as someone who has a gift, a surprise, that he's about to pop out, someone who has something that he wants to present, a present that is going to blow him away and can't wait for her to be able to unwrap his gift, he said, just says, didn't I tell you that you'll see God's glory? And so he apparently succeeded because then they rolled the stone aside and Jesus shouted, Lazarus, come out! And the dead man came out. You see, when we focus on what God didn't, we tend to believe that God can't. And we say no to the miracles that he wants to do in our lives. And it's very easy to focus on the bad circumstances around us and let those circumstances determine how we see life and what we believe about God. But the stone was rolled away and Jesus brought him out. Can you imagine the gratitude that must have been produced in those two women that when Jesus raised their brother from the dead? For the love of their brother, as well as possibly the fear of being alone, it was all taken care of in one simple, for God, a gift. How do you ever say thank you to a gift like that? How? There are many acts of kindness that there's just no way you can repay them. There's no way that you can repay an act of kindness like that, and gratitude is the only response. But how can anyone express enough gratitude for a gift like that? Well, Mary was about to give it her best shot. 6 days before the Passover began, and if you've read the Old Testament, you understand that God had established the nation of Israel to fulfill his promise of bringing the Messiah. And through the course of keeping them alive, he had led them into Egypt, which had been prophesied in Scripture. And he brought them out. But in setting them free from slavery and captivity, there was a Pharaoh who had the political clout, and he stood in the way of defiance of Moses. And the last plague was the death of the firstborn, and the firstborn angel was about to pass through and kill, as an act of judgment, the firstborn in every household, with the exception of those who had the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of their homes. Now, Passover, therefore, became that celebration of how God had freed the nation of Israel from Egypt and had saved their firstborns from death. And the Bible teaches that Jesus was about to become our Passover lamb, the one whose blood is sprinkled on the doorposts of our hearts that allows us to enter into the presence of God, not with and without the sin and the baggage that we've accumulated, but with the righteousness of Jesus himself. So Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. And the dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served as always before, and this time Lazarus was going to enjoy this party more because he wasn't spelunking with grave clothes. He was there eating with them. Martha served, but it was her sister Mary who had become the focus of this story. And then Mary came out with a gift. She had come out with a pound of fragrant oil, pure and expensive nard. Now, I don't know how to put this into context so we can understand what she had done. But she went to the safe, or she reached for that top on the top shelf for that item that was her greatest possession. It was almost the equivalent of her net worth. It was so valuable. And it was that item, that perfume that was so valuable, she wouldn't even use it on herself. It was there for safekeeping. And she brought it out. And she brought it out. And imagine taking your most valuable possession and giving it to someone else. Can you imagine possessing either of these and giving them away? Here's a car that's $1 million. And an oil change alone is $20,000. If you can find a few of those, you can work 3 days out of the year. just a thought. And yet, many of you guys have know the cost of a diamond ring and what you've paid to be able to give that gift. And you paid it gladly because of the value in the person to whom it was going to be given. Why do you think Mary had this gift? Well, the scripture is going to reveal it to us, but what we know at this point is she had this gift and it had been unused. But on this occasion, it was time to use it. You see, gratitude asks a very important question. Gratitude asks the question of what do I have of value that I can give? Not what is the cost of my gift. See, every one of us has things that we struggle with giving. There are things that we have that we've acquired and we think, man, this was expensive, and if I give it up, I won't have any more. But gratitude doesn't calculate the cost of the gift. The gratitude just calculates the value of the gift to give. Gratitude's that way. And we can see in Mary, through this, we're going to see three expressions of gratitude from her act of worship. First is that gratitude gives generously. When grateful, we give our best. When grateful, we don't care about the cost. We just want to give value. And yet, this is also how gratitude causes us to change how we see. Because gratitude causes me to look for something of value that I can give instead of counting the cost of what I'm going to give up. Gratitude changes how you and I live in that way. And she gave a gift of great value. But what did she do with it? Well, she went to Jesus and she poured it on his feet. Some would say she wasted it on his feet. Wasn't there a better, more noble use of a gift like that? I mean, crying out loud, he's the King of Kings. If she knew who he was, why would she have wasted it on his feet? You've got this gift, this possession. Surely there'd be something, a better way to use it. But you see, gratitude isn't about the gift. Gratitude isn't even about the giver. Gratitude is only about the one to whom the gift is given. It's not about the gift. It's not about the giver. It's about the recipient of the gift. And it wasn't about the cost of perfume. It wasn't about the sacrifice of Mary. It was about the best way to honor Jesus. And this was what she did with it. She poured it on his feet. See, gratitude asks another important question. Gratitude asks the question, how well can I love? Not what can I get by with? How little can I give? What is the cost of my gift? It says, what do I have of value that I can give? And how well can I love with it? The consensus in the room was she overpaid. She could have gotten by with less. She didn't have to pour it out. She didn't have to put it on her feet. And when we see these three expressions of gratitude, we see that gratitude gives generously and gratitude loves extravagantly. What does an extravagant love look like? Well, Mary's heart ran over with it. When you and I exceed expectations, we make a statement. That's why the first week of Radical Church, when we talked about radical hospitality, we talked about every person that comes through this door is a gift to God, from God. Someone that God is calling to himself. And each person that comes through, there's going to be someone who's coming for the first time. And there are going to be people who are coming for the last time. And there are people who come all the time. And we're usually in one of those or in between. And yet we have the opportunity to receive them as valued guests. And we want to love them well. And hospitality says, I want to exceed your expectations so that you know how valuable you are to me. You see, the other part of that is how well we love reveals or changes how we see God. You see, when you reach for that top shelf gift and you bring it out and you're about to give it away, what may have been an easier decision when you got it down is going to become a harder decision before you pour it out. Because at that moment, the temptation is going to be, hold on to what you've got. But here's the difference. Faith sees a God of abundance. Faith says that God gave me this for his purpose. And when I use it for the purposes of God, if I'm going to need it again, God is able to give it to me again. That's faith. Fear says, I earned it, I worked for it, it's mine. And if I give it up, I may never get it back. That's the difference between fear and faith. Fear says that God is a God of scarcity. I can't trust him to take care of my needs. Faith says that God is a God of abundance. He will give to me so that I can continue to give to others. That's why giving is so essential to experiencing God. And that's why when we are stingy, we feel that God is stingy and our faith doesn't grow. What you and I are saving it for will reveal how we see God. What are you saving it for? What sits on your top shelf? What's at home, safe and sound, unused? Or maybe you aren't saving it at all. You are using it and spending it. But for you and I, we want to understand why God gives us what he has given us. And what Mary did is she gave generously and she loved extravagantly. And sometimes we let that substitute for giving of ourselves. Sometimes we let giving substitute for going. This is what we sought to do with strategic partners. We used to call them missions. And here's why we changed. One of the reasons is there's a tendency to look at missions. First of all, the church has one mission. We don't have many missions. We have one mission, and that is may every life we touch come to know, love, and serve Jesus. And we do it here, And we support people who do it in places that we can't go. And yet the reality is it's real easy to support missionaries and just send money everywhere. But what happens is when you let money substitute for a relationship, you don't feel what they feel. What we wanted, and this is what we saw with our relationship with CASA, the orphanage that we support in Mexico. We have hundreds of deployments there a year, and people would go down, would experience their mission, the kids, and they would come back with stories. And you know what would happen when they come back with stories? Those who were carrying the stories, their lives were changed, and everyone they shared the story with, their lives were changed, and more people would go down. And that's where we saw the value of strategic partnerships is a relationship. And not only, and with that relationship, when they hurt, we hurt. When Pastor Alex in the Philippines gets bowled over with a typhoon, we get bowled over with a typhoon, and we respond. But when you spread little bits of money far and wide, you can't go very deep, and you can't respond to emergencies. Emergencies only happen to them. They don't happen to us. So we sought to narrow the field so we can go deeper with support. And we feel what they feel. And what Mary felt was she gave a gift. It was generous, and it was extravagant, but it was also personal. You see, my gift cannot be allowed to replace my person, and Mary wasn't that way, for she wiped his feet with her hair. How personal. It was all of her. And you know what? You look at this, and you think, she wiped his feet with her hair, and you've got one or two responses. How gross or how beautiful? Which is it? Can it be both? You see, it depends on what your focus and your priorities are. If you're looking out for yourself, if you're looking at yourself, you're going to say, my hair is filthy. But when you look at the recipient of the gift, you're going to see, how could I love you more? You see, what we see in Mary is that she gave generously, she loved extravagantly, and she served wholeheartedly. The scriptures say, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your hair, your strength. How do you feel when you read that verse? You know, religion looks at that and says, you know, I'm failing. And it's real easy to preach and ask a religious question that says, how are you doing with that? And ask a leading question that gets a religious response, to which humble people say, I'm failing, and proud people say, I'm doing great. And the reality is, whenever you ask a religious question, the response elicited is usually the opposite of the truth. Humble people are doing better than they think, and religious people aren't all that hot. But when you and I look at that, that's a religious answer that says, you know what? I'm falling short in my heart, my soul, my mind, and strength. Woe is me, I'm a mess. Faith looks at that differently. Faith doesn't look at that and look at the gap. Faith looks at that and sees an opportunity. Faith says, you know what? I think I can give more of my heart. I think I can give more of my soul. I think I've got more of my mind that I can give, and I got more of my strength that I can pour out. Faith says, I want to surrender more of me. And the question with that is, what part of you is off limits to God? What part remains in the safe? What stays on the top shelf? What is surrendered and off limits in your relationship with him? Jesus said in Revelation 3:20, listen. And he's not saying that, as some would say. I hear people say all the time, God has to hit me with a 2x4. No, he's saying, listen. Listen, my friend. Hear the knock at the door. Listen for my voice. You're busy. Slow down. Listen. Because an opportunity awaits you, and if you hear my voice, and if you open the door, you know what will happen? I will come in, and I will eat with you, and you will eat with me. This is why growing in our faith, I'm going to show you how growing in our faith isn't about striving, it's about surrendering, it's about opening doors. We look at that and we think, okay, this is where the saying, invite Jesus into your heart, comes in. But I want to propose to you that your heart has more than one door. There is a door into your heart, But in your heart, there are many compartments as well, aren't there? In fact, when you bring Jesus in, you may be comfortable with him coming in this far, in the foyer. Yeah, Jesus, look around. How do you like the way I've decorated? Isn't this room beautiful? You like my choice of paints and the decorations on the wall? And Jesus said, hey, can I come in? Sure, why don't you come down and sit in the living room? And you sit there and you visit for a while. And then Jesus says, hey, what's down this hallway? Oh, nothing. Well, okay, let's go. So Jesus comes down and he knocks on another door and he tries on. It's locked. What's in here? And you've got a choice. You can either run out the house yourself, or you can throw him out, or you can try to make excuses and divert his attention and try to get him back in the living room. Instead, what we want to do, and this is why spiritual growth is about surrender and growing in my faith, is opening more doors than I've been comfortable opening yesterday. And you say, okay, Jesus, I was afraid you'd find this. Let's go in. And you not only open the door, but in order to keep the door open and to give him continued access, what do you got to do? Well, you got to at least leave the door unlocked, but maybe you're going to have to remove the lock, take off the doorknob, or you may have to take that door off its hinges altogether because you've just surrendered another place in your heart that you didn't have the faith to surrender yesterday. And that's why growing in our faith isn't about striving and getting better and redecorating and looking prettier. It's about surrendering more and more rooms in my heart and giving him all the access to everything, because that's his desire for your good and mine and for his glory. You see, gratitude asks an important question. It says, how much of me can I give? Not how much of me can I keep? You don't count how many rooms you're able to keep off limits. You talk about the rooms that are newly surrendered. Mary poured out everything. And we can see three expressions of gratitude. One, she gave generously. Second, she loved extravagantly. And third, she served wholeheartedly. What does wholehearted service look like? Well, it changes how you see your possessions, because you give the gift of yourself. You give your personal time. You give your personal touch. You give something you can't get back. Meaning, you don't give to get repaid. You pour it out. As a result, the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. What a beautiful gift. But yet, others in that circle saw it differently. Religious people always do. Judas, the notorious Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would betray him, said that perfume, and here's how you know the value of her gift. It's Judas. See, religious people not only calculate the value, the cost of their own gift, but they'll calculate the cost of the gift of others. And he said, that perfume was worth a whole year's wages. Now, at that moment, he had just declared something that I don't think he was aware of. And Jesus, you're not worth it. That perfume that she just poured out was worth a whole year's wages. What a waste. Why waste it on Jesus? He's not worth it. And that is what we say when we calculate the cost of our gifts, when we calculate what we hold back in worship. Worship is the only thing you and I can give to God that he hasn't given us first, and it is what reveals the most about the gratitude that's in there. But then after he realized that, he tried to cover his tracks, I believe, and he tried to come up with something religious. And he said, it should have been sold and the money given to the poor. Who could argue with that? Logical, reasonable, compassionate, and religious. Devaluing to his relationship with Jesus. But he made the point, what a waste. What a waste. And I love Jesus' response, especially love it as a daddy of daughters. He said, leave her alone. Leave her alone. It was directed right at Judas, looked him square in the eye, and spoken just to him. Why did Jesus accept such an extravagant gift? Because it does sound, religiously speaking, that Judas had a good point. Well, I think there are two reasons. First of all, it's not that Judas cared for the poor. The scriptures say he was a thief, and he was in charge of the disciples' money. and he often stole some for himself. Now, let's pause here for a moment and ask a question. If Jesus knows all things, why did he allow Judas to be in charge of the money? What do you think? It's because he doesn't put as much value on money as someone who would ask that question. If you and I ask that question, it means we value money more than Jesus did. And it also, I think, when we are afraid that we've got to, when we're afraid of losing money, it reveals a scarcity mentality of God instead of seeing God a God of abundance. When you and I hold on, we hold back, we are saying that God isn't able. And so one was Judas was posing so he could steal the money. He was pretending to care for the poor, and that's religious. Let's look for a second reason why Jesus said, leave her alone. And he referred to Mary when he said, and this explains why she had the perfume. She has kept it for the day of my burial. She has kept this perfume for the day of my burial. Now, everybody else was just kind of going along. They didn't know what was going to be at the end of the week, but Jesus did. And apparently Mary did too. Mary, reason number two, was preparing Jesus for his death. Now, did she even know she was doing this? I don't know. It could be something. Sometimes God uses us in ways that we aren't even aware. That's why when we obey God today and do it again tomorrow, God leads us through his providence so that we're in the center of his will at any point in time. When you and I continue to honor God and obey him each day, he leads us and we'll be in the center of his will. If you're worried about how to be in God's will, obey him today. Honor him and today. Do it again tomorrow. Mary may have just been doing this and it was something the Spirit spoke and she obeyed. She got it down. She poured it out. I don't know. But it's possible. It's possible that only Mary knew what was ahead. And here's why I think that's possible. Because I believe that people who sit at Jesus' feet are shown things that other people don't see. People who sit at Jesus' feet, those who sit at Jesus' feet often have spiritual insights others don't possess. And Mary was that kind of person. When others were busy, she was kneeling, she was at his feet. And if you admire or envy people with that spiritual insight, I've got one simple solution for you. Establish a time and a place with God that is the most important appointment on your calendar. Because here's the thing, and we talked about this a year or two ago in our Simplify series. What you move for God says more to your kids about what's important for you. You think it's what you do, and what you do is what you believe. But even more than what you do, it's what you move. What gets moved for God, and what is God moved for? Well, Jesus affirmed Mary's gratitude as an appropriate response. And let's see how that parallels with the gift he gave. First of all, Jesus gave generously, don't you think? The cross was costly. That's what a generous gift looks like. He gave his best. He gave more, far more than I deserved. And his gift was appropriate. It was the necessary price for my sin and yours. Secondly, Jesus loved extravagantly. How is the cross extravagant? Well, many would look at that and say, what a waste. He didn't have to give that much. He could have gotten by with less. He poured himself out. He held nothing back. It's like the song that is being sung these days. He didn't give his heart in pieces. He didn't say, okay, here's a little bit. I'll give more if I have to. He poured it out. And to the extent he gave himself for me is the extent that I want to give myself for him. Not in a religious way, but in as a desire, as an opportunity. And I'm not sure I finished that point earlier. I apologize. But when I look at my heart, my strength, my soul, and my mind, I say, you know what? There's more in there I can surrender, and I want to. Do you have anything you're holding back right now? What do you have in you that you can give, that you may be holding, because if you give it away, you might not get it back, or You're wanting to use your gifts for yourself. You may ask, what difference will it make? A lot of people a couple weeks ago didn't vote because they said, what difference will it make? Well, what difference will it make? Well, here's the difference the attitude of gratitude will make in your life. It will change how you see life. For instead of seeing what you lack, you will see instead what you have. The power of gratitude. It will change how you see God. Instead of seeing what he didn't, you will see what he did. That's the power of gratitude. It will change how you see your possessions. Instead of seeing what you lack, you will see you have something to give. For I find that when my attitude goes astray, when I'm discouraged or I'm struggling or I'm finding that my emotions are interpreting how I see life, I find that expressing gratitude has the power to change all that. Telling someone thank you has already changed how I see. Giving a gift of appreciation increases the value I placed on that person. And when I see life differently, I treat people differently, and they are changed too. And I believe the same is true of you as it is for me and for all of us. Imagine what it would be like to be a church of radical gratitude. You see, gratitude causes us to see what God can instead of what God hasn't. That's why the power of radical gratitude is immense. What makes it radical? Well, when you ask somebody, how are you, what do they say? They're either going to say, fine, which means I don't want to tell you, or I can't complain. How do you respond to someone that says, I can't complain? I say, oh, yes, you could, but you choose not to. And this is where radical gratitude kicks in. Because radical gratitude is deliberately focusing on the reasons you have to be grateful instead of the plenty of reasons you have not to be. When you choose to overlook the reasons that you have to be upset and disappointed and instead see the reasons you have to be grateful, that's radical. How do you do it? Well, your next step is just choose to look for the blessings. Secondly, maybe your next step is to establish that time and a place with God, that big rock in your jar that the rest of life flows around instead of a balloon that just floats around with every other priority, in response to every other priority. How about letting each day feature an expression of gratitude? What if we got up every morning looking for a reason to be grateful and a way to express it? And then when we find it, we give generously, we love extravagantly, and we serve wholeheartedly. You know what the result is? A radical church with radical gratitude. And it changes everything just by choosing our outlook on today. And I believe that's a recipe for a very happy Thanksgiving.